Hey there, howdy ho, welcome back, friends. This is Daniel Markham at the DanielBMarkham.com channel, and today we're back for yet another Nerd Roundup. And if you've never been to a Nerd Roundup before, you're in for a treat, because what we do every week here is we try to talk about really cool technical stuff without actually saying anything useful or informative. But the goal is that every team, to be successful, should be able to relax, kick back, talk about the news of the day without sort of getting into sort of endless argument. So instead of, we'd like to model the behavior you want to see. So instead of sort of arguing with one another like people are want to do on the net, we thought we'd just kind of take a day, an hour every week, and just talk about cool stuff and have fun doing it. This week, it's James Grinning. James, howdy, sir.
Howdy, Daniel. Howdy, partner.
Partner? I have to work on my, I told Melissa we should get those little stick horses we could ride around and maybe the cap guns, but.
Oh, yeah.
Can't find us. So how's your week been?
My week's been busy, you know, that's part of my MO. I learned a couple of interesting things, and before I forget, though, I had one of our listeners, one of our watchers, Diego Pego, and I think I'm probably not saying his name properly. He's from Brazil, and I want to say hi and thank him,
yes,
because he's been helping me with some stuff. He's done some great work on my website, in some of my new content, finding all the mistakes that I sprinkle around when I'm working on stuff that I don't have tests for. I mean, like, you can't test text. I guess you could run it through a spell check, but so he's been helping me with that, and that was really cool. And so, Diego, thank you very much,
yes,
for that help.
I want to second that too, Diego. Diego's been really kind to me online. He's always been supportive and responsive. It's been a really cool person to get to know. One of these days, we're gonna have to do some sort of, I don't know, nerd herd show or something where all our regular watchers can come on and we can do the same thing, just with a bigger crowd.
Yeah. And the other thing that I was doing, you know, so I've told you about my saga of making these videos and trying to make a self-paced version of my training class. And usually the way I would do a video, Bob long ago said, James, you got to write a script, and you know, then you can just do the script. It's like, okay, great. And I think you and I have a similar thing. You said you bought the script writing tool, and then it didn't produce any scripts.
Yeah, I bought three script writing tools because I was really not a damn one, but I was really serious about writing. Yeah, I'm not just buying the one. I'm going all for three.
Yeah, so. My usual MO is like, okay, I put some ideas on the screen here in front of me, and I just start talking. You know, presentations I've given, dozens of times, hundreds of times before, and I flub up and that sort of thing. And so the editing process was a complete pain. So I thought, I'm going to try something different this time. I sat down and gave myself the presentation with Google text to voice. I don't know what they call it, but basically dictation. And it was making a doc for me as I'm talking, you know, and it messed things up, so I'd stop and I'd fix it. But basically, I could get all the words that I needed to say without all the extra garbage into the script. And then, this is probably no surprise for people who actually know what they're doing in this sort of thing, but I'm just learning all this stuff on my own. Then I put it into a teleprompter up here and go about talking in front of a green screen. And, so it's much easier to edit when I've done it this way rather than my usual, for a half hour thing, I've probably got 2 hours of video I've got to crunch down instead of, 6 hours of, of flubbed up videos.
This is a different kind of work for us. I do this, a similar thing. I love taking pictures. And so I had to develop sort of a picture taking, I guess, production flow. And so I do the gear at one point, I do the composing at one point, and I have a whole flow. And if I did it out of order, it didn't work, and I had to sort of develop my own version of that. This seems like it's sort of a similar thing.
Yeah, find out what works for you, right?
Yeah, and I've struggled with this same thing, and Bob told me this many years ago to do a script, and I've made so many mistakes. I guess finally I will run out of ways of making mistakes, and I will fail at failing further, and at that point I'm going to have the whole thing down. They say that people who struggle a lot with things are usually the best people to teach it because they've been through sort of the pains of learning.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to be awesome at this whole, once I get this script thing worked out.
Once you get it down, you're going to change your business into coaching people making videos. So what have you been up to this week, Daniel?
Well, we did quite a bit of traveling over the long holiday weekend. We went to my wife's family. She has approximately 4,721 relatives.
Great.
Of which I can remember maybe three names. she has a really huge family, about 4 hours away. So we went there and saw all those guys, or at least some of them, maybe 30 or 40. So that was fun. After we talked last week, I said I was going to go on a laminating spree. I got out Photoshop, speaking of production flows. And I was telling you earlier that I have three books, so two that are done. I'm working on the third now. And somehow or another, and this is not something I had planned, I actually started this sort of graphic, this way of describing programming, in the first book that's going to carry all the way through all three books. And I thought that was pretty cool that it's going to hold out like that, and that's maybe can be some training material at some point.
Yeah, cool. Sounds good.
Yeah, I just need something with more rubber chickens. I really haven't developed as many rubber chicken methodologies as I should, but I...
You've been slack.
I have been slack. It's really funny because the first book I was quite nervous about doing. I didn't want to do it. And so it was really kind of free form, told a lot of jokes because I tell jokes when I'm under stress. And then as I've got along, it's gotten much more detailed and all this little, tiny stuff. And here's the sourcing. Here are the links to all this other stuff. And I don't know if that's good or maybe I should have just gone back to the joke. I may actually be going the wrong way with this, James. I'm not sure.
Well, sometimes you got to do that. Find out what works.
Yeah, yes, I think the most important part of the whole book writing process is just getting the damn thing out.
Yeah,
I think I learned this from John Kern, or maybe it was another author, but it was like, Daniel, stop fretting over the whole book, sit down, make it happen, and then go back and fret over making it a really good book after that.
Oh, okay.
Good advice.
Yeah, I know when I did my book, the title changed about four times throughout the whole thing, and the content did too. And then the publisher just said, "Okay, you've got to be done now. You've got 2 weeks left. No more changes."
Oh wow!
Yeah,
you have an excellent book. Michael Feathers has an excellent. Bob has, of course, more than one good book. I find that most books that we read in our business are not that good, and I really want to make sure I write some. If I'm going to write, that I make sure as good as I can make it.
Yeah, when I get my video making done, I'm going to pick your books up. Definitely. Well, are they pick up or they're virtual?
Right now they're virtual. I'm only going to do three books in my entire life. I'm not sure I'll do the third one. Once I finish all three, I'm probably going to go back to the first one. Go back to them again. It's just basically how to sound and solve problems using technology for people.
Cool.
It's something I've always been pretty good at, and I'm hoping I can at least be half-ass better explaining than I've read so far.
Mm-hmm.
So it's on with the links, my friend.
Yeah, sounds good. On with the links, yes.
The first
nerditry.
Nerditry. Bring on the nerditry. First link is anti-aging pill, U.S. military testing pill that delays aging.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wish I had that about 20 years ago.
Yeah, because you can imagine the problems they have with geriatric people in the military. There's just the full of people with walkers, They've got to do all they can to prevent that.
I'm probably too late as a candidate, huh?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because when I went into basic training, I was the old guy.
Thanks a lot for that, Dan.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you, too. I'm just, when I went into basic training, I was the old guy, and I was like 19. And I was the senior guy. Some of these military services are highly demanding physically. So I imagine the real goal here is to get a few more years out of people in their 20s at the max.
Or maybe, so they're not like total cripples when they're older after they retire.
Yes.
That's kind of benevolent.
Yes, but, very much so. You look at the football stars, military, special operators, a lot of those guys do not have happy lives. They have a lot of pain.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that my knees don't work so good anymore because, my dad, he lived to 90. He's a fighter pilot. And I think the thing is that he never complained anything. So I figured I'm not going to have any problems. Dad never complained about anything. And, you know, my knees hurt already. My knees are hurting. It's like, I'm asking my brother, it's like, did Dad ever complain to you? It's like, no. And we concluded either that it wasn't hurting or fighter pilots don't complain about stuff like that. Might be the latter.
I believe it is the latter. My stepdad was a mechanic for fighter airplanes, and I think he was in a lot of pain, but he never, ever mentioned. He was just kind of cranky at times, and that was the reason why.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I understand that one. All right, so this pill, they're talking about these small molecules that can invade, can go into your mitochondria and kind of help the processes keep going, making the right stuff to keep you healthy. Is that the gist?
That is it. It's a nutraceutical, which is it's not a drug. It's sort of a chemical that works like a drug, but isn't as powerful, I guess.
Yeah, I think they're talking about it's going to be preventative. So things that, you know, when your chemistry, your body starts to go bad as you age, it's going to prevent some of that, if I'm reading between the lines right.
We've talked about this before. This aging discussion is fascinating because a lot of people are starting to treat aging as a disease that shouldn't happen. Hmm. And there's another group of people that says, no, there's nothing you can do to prevent aging. And so there's this really interesting scientific debate back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the most interesting stories is the one where they're actually doing blood transfusions have you heard about this, between young people and older?
No.
Oh, yeah. So the idea is...
young people get the old blood, or they just...
Oh, the old people get the young blood. And so instead of trying to figure out, like, what can keep you young or make you young, they just give you a transfusion from a young person.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to be working, which is really weird. It's got kind of a vampire feel to the whole thing.
Maybe it's kind of like the flushing the system.
Yeah, and the younger people start complaining at the cafeteria places a lot after that. I'm not really sure. You call this a special, huh?
Yeah, what is that? Is that all I get?
Yeah, hey, it's $10 here. And as with all of these anti-aging things, who knows? You know, we'll find out. It'll come out in the wash. Next up is this really cool essay, kind of a lengthy one, on 8 lessons he learned from 20 years of hype cycles. So are you familiar with the Garner hype cycle?
Yeah, I was glancing at some of the pictures in this one. I didn't have time to read it in detail, but I do recognize the trough of, what's it called? The trough of
despair, was it? Trough of disillusionment.
I'm talking about this cycle when he was teaching object-oriented design in the 90s. And he'd described the bathtub curve. It's like you're on day one of your training. You're all excited. And don't worry, in about 2 hours, you're going to be down here in the bottom of the bathtub. And hopefully by the end of the, you know, the week, we're going to get you back up.
I know. When I learned functional programming, I really convinced I wanted to do pure functional programming. I had this list of things I didn't want to do. And I started with the language that I could do OO programming in. And so I figured that would sort of make it easier, and I lost a lot of ground for, I don't know, several months, maybe even a year. And the thing is, I could code it initially the way I used to code, but then I had to like go back and clean it up and figure out how I should have coded it as a functional coder.
Yeah.
And it was slow going, but then I found out I sort of developed a set of little small skills, like TDD, except for functional programming, and I just put together the small skills and it works out fine. So that's a real thing.
Yep.
So
this bathtub curve happens to people adopting TDD for embedded.
Yes.
So one of the things is, you know, the enthusiasm for doing it on simple code that's new and greenfield, right? That's that curve where you end up, I think this could work for this. And then we talk about legacy code next, and it's like, oh, now what do I do? Because I actually can't do any of this because I've got too much existing code. My code goes into my code, into my existing world, and now what do I do, right? You know, so then that's the longer trip out of that that trough. There is a path, though, by the way. So
absolutely. I think one of the saddest things I've seen is people who kind of get that first spike and never make it through the trough afterwards. And it's like, oh, man, you had a vision. You were almost there. You just have to stick with it, you know?
Yeah, you got to look at the possibilities of that peak are one thing, and then the reality of, you know, how can I apply it in my world is a different thing.
Yes. Well, I think the story, at least for me, for most of technology, is the fact that you you kind of first see where you're going to go, and you get excited about that, and you understand it. And then there's just this period in which you're just going to have to slog away at it. You're like fighting through the hedgerows. And yeah. if you keep the faith and have, you know, sort of have faith it's going to work out, you're fine. But it's just so easy to get despair. If somebody sitting next to you says, oh, I went to that class last year, it's no good. It's so easy just to give up.
Yeah.
I was talking to a friend of mine last week. He's signing on as vice president of development somewhere or another. And I remember it wasn't even 10 years ago, I think, that he was doing TED with Clean Code, and they were real excited about it. And he was a lead at that point, and he decided, no, guys, we're going to do this if it kills us. We're just going to do it. And they did. And then they started a whole kata about bringing people on. They did an onboarding thing. He became a manager. He just kept moving up because he did not give up.
Yeah, there you go. There's something about not giving up.
There's something about in this business about just sort of, okay, fine, this may take 1,000 years. I'm going to move this one little grain of sand if I had, because I know I'm going to build a mountain one day.
That's right, yep.
So if you're for those interested, go to this article. He's got a whole bunch of things, technologies that got a lot of hype that we thought were going to be really cool that didn't work out, technologies that just went for a little bit and died. It's some cool stories.
I saw your internet provided, your internet connectivity technology. You mentioned WiMAX.
Yeah.
It's on the list. So I think it doesn't mean that this technology went away. It's just it didn't pan out to be the thing it was supposed to be.
Yeah, I think I may have misused the WiMAX term. Basically, we're using the 5 gigahertz spectrum, which WiMAX uses. And yeah. It's a directed microwave beam to a repeater on top of a nearby mountain. Whether or not it's actually WiMAX or not,
I see. Yeah, okay.
I don't know if WiMAX is the whole thing or just the technology part or the protocol or what.
But mesh networks are alive and well. I've done a little bit of toying with IoT gadgets, and these radios you can string out for miles as long as they can talk to each other, and you tell them what the hop count is. You know, they'll keep talking to each other and making sure messages get to the right place.
Well, you read that Amazon has decided that unless you opt out, they're upgrading all of their devices in your home to actually participate in a mesh network.
Hmm.
And so they decided people who own Amazon products that have radios in them are going to be, by default, members of this Amazon. And the reason why is just to do connectivity for the other IoT stuff.
Yeah, okay.
But it's kind of
weird.
So
your refrigerator is when it's out of mustard.
Yeah, it's just kind of weird that they would suddenly decide that you have to opt out or we're going to turn on the radios on all your stuff. It just kind of doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah, I don't. Oh, you mean rather than opt in?
Yes.
Hmm. So how do you know this? Did you actually go read all that fine print? Are you one of those guys?
No. I don't actually read in this job at all, James. I try. I get the comic version of the technology news. It's got the big color pictures. No, it was I saw an article on I think Hacker News a week and a half ago. And then the next day, some of my Amazon devices rebooted. Fortunately, I don't have the radio turned on anyway, but I know what they were doing. They were just a massive update.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have that surveillance system running in my house.
I don't either. I've got the Alexa thing on a remote that you have to push the button for.
Oh.
And other than that, I've got nothing that's voice activated except for the GOOGLE thing that's on my phone.
Yeah, okay. Don't say that.
We don't say the G word around here because we end up with reminders and calling people. It's no good.
I was thinking that someday, you know, if I had an Alexa around the house, I'd say, Alexa, tell me everything we said in the last 15 minutes, right?
Oh, wow.
I wonder if that would work.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. My daughter actually got a Ring, Amazon Ring, that's a little doorbell thing with a camera. And they can actually just pull off the video and sound without even asking you for that thing. It's kind of crazy stuff.
Yep.
So speaking of doing things without asking folks, the next story is Audacity 3.0 called Spyware over data collection changes by new owner. Have you used Audacity? You know what Audacity is?
I have no idea what Audacity is.
So it's for Ubuntu. It's the freeware audio editing stuff. It's really, really sophisticated. I haven't used it a lot, but it does whatever you want to do with audio editing.
Oh, and did you say it's on Ubuntu?
Yes.
Oh.
And the story, the backstory here is that it was freeware owned by one guy who let everybody develop on it. And then he sold to a big company. big company is now changing the terms and conditions of the software so that they can basically take the things you're recording and editing and sell them to other people.
Yeah.
And for some reason,
I've got Audacity on my computer. Might have to get rid of it.
Well, yeah, it's sort of typical of these tech stories because, you know, first is this article, you know, Audacity is spyware. And then you go to this next link and it's like, you know, maybe actually it isn't spyware. And the longer story is Audacity doesn't keep your email anyway. So while it may be, while technically they may have given themselves permission to like keep some of this stuff, they don't actually, there's nothing for them to do. The only thing they can do is associate your IP with some of the operations you performed in the tool. But at the same time, I mean, really, does everything have to be telemetry now? Everything?
Yep. Well, you know, I know in the old days, back when I was a kid, you know, we wanted to know what features our customer was using from our products, you know,
yes.
So I can understand that desire to know that, right? Because, you know, otherwise your systems keep growing and growing and growing, and if you don't ever throw anything out, right? So, because we're trying to reinvent some things. We don't know if anybody's using the features. And so the starting point was always everything the current system could do and all the stuff we're dreaming of. It's like, it's a high bar.
I remember I had a project, I guess 5 or 6 years ago. It was an existing product, been out, deployed in company, I think 30, 40,000 users for a while. And they were looking at doing a rewrite. And it was a web product. So the first thing I asked was, well, who's using what? And how many of these features are common or whatever? And nobody knew.
That's right.
And I was like, well, could you put like instrumentation just on the web pages? Just tell me which pages they're pulling down and we can look at that. And nobody even had that on. So that was sort of the first thing we did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get the idea of using telemetry to some degree. I think like everything else, it was sort of a good idea. That's just, at what point do you stop?
Yeah, I've started, I just put a log file on my website so that when I'm teaching a class, you know, there's some things that people are supposed to do, and I have no way of knowing if they do them. And I still will have no way of knowing if they'll do them, but I'll at least know if they went to the web page where the things that they were supposed to do was. And, you know, there's videos and things to watch.
Yes.
You know, so now I'll know that. So I guess I'm starting the surveillance thing too, but hey, they gave me their...
you're kind of teaching them. They're kind of expected to do some kind of... I started blogging back, 20 years ago, I think, a long, long time ago. And almost the first thing I did was, you know, every day I would blog and then look at the statistics. I had 7 people come by today. I think there's a problem there with content providers because you get in this sort of fast feedback loop where you're just trying to create things to get people to visit.
Yeah. Well, some of my stuff, if they don't do it, then they're going to be lost the next day. And so I'm trying to make that really clear. You know, so there'll be homework every day, and some of the homework is optional, but now I'm making sure that the ones that you got to do are to not be lost the next day are highlighted.
Yeah, there's a lot that builds on itself. With you, you've got the stubbing code you use at first, and the stubbing code, then you build on top of that, and you use that code as sort of a framework to then emulate the hardware underneath, and there's stuff you got to know to keep going forward.
Yeah, it all is building. You know, so you're writing books. The Pragmatic Programmer had a model that they have their authors follow, which is called the Hero's Journey. You're probably familiar with it. But you start out with a lot of, and I noticed it in one of the articles today, the words Hero's Journey were in there. But you start the Hero's Journey because they're on a quest, and you have to help them a lot because they don't know much about their quest. They just can see that they're on this quest. But as they go, they grow. And so when you're with the Pragmatic Programmers, it's like you have to trust that people, as they're reading your book, they're actually learning something. And so you don't provide every minute detail all the way through the book.
Right.
You start to let them fill in the gaps as a respect to the learner. And my training classes are pretty much built the same way. You know, so that hold their hands a lot in the beginning and then let go, you know, as we progress through the material.
There's really a meta level here that's really cool in that we teach some basics, you know, coding, debugging, testing, and we go through a little, you know, some exercises where we can do some basics, but then we kind of back up and say, okay, we're going to trust you to do the basics and keep working on those skills. Now let's talk about here's how to think about what you're doing, because if you once you learn how to think about it, then you'll realize you're missing some more skills in the basic area, or you practice some more, whatever. That kind of gives you a place to go.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, I love to walk coders through. Okay, this is why we're doing this, because you know it makes sense 6 months from now. Right now, it might not make sense, but if you don't do it, acceptance tests are a good example. We used to do the chartering for projects. And it's like, if you can't write down in a sentence or two why you have a project, you probably should not have a project. But I have been to more than one team where I've asked, you know, what are you guys doing? And they didn't know. And then I asked, well, where are your sponsors? And they didn't know that either.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm searching around through management saying, okay, who's paying these guys? Why are these people making money? Because if you can tell me that, maybe we can come up with some sort of reason the team is here.
Yeah. Yeah, there's my first business trip in a year and a half is going to happen in a couple of months. And actually, when's it going to happen? It's going to happen in September. And we're going to do a workshop with that. And that's part of the homework is, you know, why are you here?
Yes.
Do we have the right people? Do we know what we're working on? Aside from the end date, you know, what do we know?
We know we're going to be done. Yeah.
We need it.
I had this project once we were building for users that hated us. It was kind of strange. The company decided they were going to build a product, and the users didn't want it, but the company decided anyway. So here we are coding this product nobody wants. And we were always quite interested, like, yeah, you guys still want us to be doing and our sponsors either kind of came and go. They were either really enthusiastic or not, depending on how the politics were working out in company.
Yeah. Sounds like I've read a Dilbert like that before.
Oh, my God. It was hilarious. And one of the things we were doing was vision insurance. And so we had to print these letters for folks to tell them they couldn't get their glasses because their insurance didn't cover it. I'm like, what does it make? Difference does it make pulling from the letter? They can't read the damn letter anyway. Send some Lipsum Aurum stuff. They don't know. Oh, but no, it was, you have to stay motivated. That was one of my first commercial jobs. And in that job, I met a really great guy. His name was Matt. He was doing a lot of UI stuff. And he was, I guess, what I would consider sort of an artistic kind of foofy, you know, probably smoked a lot of pot. Kind of nice person, just very creative, not my kind of guy. But he was like, Daniel, why the hell are we doing this? Makes no sense. And he was, you know, quite distraught. And I was like, I'm with you, but, you know, it seems like these people seem to know what they're doing. It was my first job. They seem to know what they're doing. I guess we'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't. Crashed and burned.
And we didn't.
Yeah, well, but I had faith at the time. It was the poor thing.
Yeah, it's a shame when good work gets spent on something not needed.
Yeah, that's the flip side of that, sort of having faith and taking a long time, is you have to have faith, not that it's going to work out, but that you're doing some sort of day-by-day thing that's going to make it work out.
Yeah, sure.
That was the part I missed at the time.
Well, and a vision towards something that might be useful.
Well, one of the best lessons I ever learned was just simple ATD scripting. It's like, hey, what do you want this to do? Write it down, and I'll come back in a week and I'll do this. And just that simple practice takes maybe half hour. Just changed my whole practice because the things I did were building on the things I did the previous week.
Yep. There you go. Iterative and incremental.
Yes. And I tell you, the really cool thing was it taught the customers how to actually speak in programmer terms so that they would get what they wanted.
Yeah.
So this next article is The Rotting Internet is a Collective Hallucination. And I glanced at this and I was like, oh, man, this guy has to be smoking crack. This doesn't make sense. But, you know, dang it, if he ain't onto something here. We talked, I think, last week about the Russian fakes and the fake videos and how you can spoof out data and end up getting on Wikipedia. And if you're not careful, there can be a lot of false information online. This guy kind of makes the opposite case, which is just as scary, which is true things can come online and then disappear and you can't find them anymore. And his point is that, you know, we come back, look at stuff even from 10 years ago, and you can't, it's just gone.
Well, sure. Why?
Well, before we had magazines, newspapers, libraries, you know, if the mayor said something in the public square this week, you could come back 50 years later, dig up the newspaper, it was there. Here, we're recording everything we used to record newspapers on the internet, and it's just going away.
Yeah, I bumped into a site this week. What was I Googling? I was searching for something, and I came across this place, which was this 5 billion web pages that have been grabbed off the net and saved for posterity.
Yeah, I think archive.org may be what you're talking about.
It was a more frivolous name, because I was searching for something. I forget what. I might go look that up and give it to you, because maybe it would be something for us to talk about one day. But it was, I bumped into it. It's like, oh, this looks like, an interesting place. I wonder if it's got my old website in it. It was.
But I think it was quite disturbing, because, the thing is that the state of human knowledge at any given point in time is debatable. So, I think the Russians did this, you think they did that, and so we can go online and research the data and have a discussion or whatever. So yep. If we have a snapshot of all that stuff that has existed at that time, researchers from 100 years in the future can come back and figure out what was going on. But if it's all constantly shifting around and disappearing or being changed or edited, it really yep. takes away our ability to learn things.
Yeah. Yeah, the memory hole.
Yeah. So on one hand, if you go out and you punch a clown or something, and they take a YouTube video, it probably will stay on 50 years as long as people are laughing at it. But if you cure world hunger and nobody sees your video, then a month later, you can't find it in the search index anymore.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that ability to cure world hunger?
I do. It's called cooking meals. There's a follow-on problem of finding meals and cooking, but...
okay.
That's so funny. I was reading an article about a year ago. It was like, to solve poverty, we need to give people money. I would go with that. I'm not sure anything.
You got to get people doing something productive.
It's kind of like to say, to make a square round, we draw a circle. It's like, yeah, you provided an answer, but I'm not really sure you provided an answer.
Yeah, if people had money, okay.
Yeah, but they wouldn't be poor. Oh, yeah, wow. Right. Okay. I went to college for this. I got a degree. Yeah, and so then there was insert lots of political bickering after that. This next article is, where are we going from here? Software engineering needs formal methods. And James is frozen, so I will continue talking until he pops back up again. So this is kind of a nice little essay here. The guy, first he mentions Copilot. James, come back. Come back, James. There he is, James.
Hey, where have you been?
I don't know. I just took a break. So this is a software formal.
I put this green ball up here, and then
I went away. Oh my god!
And then the whole thing went away. So it's like I thought I did it with this move right here.
Yeah. So I know the jokes are getting bad if like you reach for the green ball, because then like the whole thing will go down and. Mm-hmm. This is this formal methods essay, and the first thing I got to mention is GitHub's Copilot. Have you read about GitHub's Copilot?
No, I did feel like I wanted to click that link, but this was about 10 minutes before we started, so I didn't.
Oh, the Copilot is, I'm not sure if it's gee whiz or holy shit. Basically what they've done, they've taken all the code on GitHub.
How are those different, by the way?
Gee whiz is, hey, it might be ice cream. Holy shit is somebody may have put poison in it. It looks like ice cream either way. Yeah, they took all the code from GitHub, ran it through a statistical inference engine, and now it's like if you start typing, for A equals, or I, for int A equals I to, it just, it finds out statistically what people would naturally type after those little symbols, and it just comes in your code.
What?
Yeah. It's kind of like an automated Stack Overflow. It's like you don't have to go search anymore.
Okay, it searches, on your behalf.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So it's just all the code's already there. And, once you start typing, it can sort of guess what you might want to do.
Wow. That's interesting.
It's like we're not good enough yet at dumping tons of crappy code out. Let's automate it. Woo!
Uh-huh. We want to emulate all the code that's out there. Yeah, so definitely. This is great.
Exactly. Because everything we have out there is so perfect.
Uh-huh.
I guess eventually we'll have code that changes. The computer will be changing while you're trying to debug it. Come back here.
Yeah.
So he starts off with a Copilot, and he makes a point that a lot of junior even some senior coders make, which is, you know, gee, if we could just do better specifications, we would be better programmers. And I struggle with this, like we do with several of these articles we talk about Nerd Roundup. Is there something actually here that's useful or not? And I don't know.
You know, if I had somebody that wasn't me working on my website, I don't know how I could specify what I want, because I kind of have to discover what I know what problem it's trying to be solved, but then there's a discovery of what a good solution to that is.
Yes.
And yeah, so what does requirements mean, you know,
yes,
in that context? It's like, okay, well, it might mean, do I really understand what problem is trying to be solved?
Yes.
And, you know, the solution takes a different form as, you know, you discover what's possible, what's easy, what's hard.
You should be learning from the programming process.
Yeah, sure. Yep. Yeah, somebody, I forget who I first heard that from, but I've got a little note in one of my slides about it. It's like, there's a scale. You know, as you deliver features, there's another scale. I'm, you know, doing the same thing, which is you learned stuff. And, you know, so as you're delivering features, you're learning things. And, you know, and the code is really just an embodiment of what you learned. And you've recorded it.
Yes.
You happen to record it in code. You know, what problem am I solving and how am I solving it gets recorded.
Well, it's more than that, really. The code is not only recording what you've learned, it's keeping what you've learned consistent with itself day by day over a period of time.
Yeah, if you do that, yeah.
If you do that.
If you can be successful at that.
The interesting thing, we're talking about my books, and Michael Feathers and I have talked many times about the fact that the system actually ends up probably changing us more than we end up changing the system, but nobody really talks about that much. It's so odd.
Yeah.
So I think the problem I have with this essay is not that it's bad or wrong. It's that it's another one of those essays that sort of starts with the idea that, you know, it's a blank slate. I sit down as a programmer and, you know, I make sure there are specifications that then go into the code. It's like, well, no, it's actually a back and forth between you and the legacy code and the people who are making decisions and the language you're using. And there's a whole lot more going on than just, I should write good specs.
Well, yeah. And if you want to, like, read test-driven into everything, you know, at one level, test-driven is creation of a spec and then creation of an implementation in a tight feedback loop. ATDD and BDD are like that, right? Just a different level. But so was the premise here that you wouldn't need the iteration? I didn't notice that. I scanned this article a little bit. But,
yeah, the good part of this was he brings us some cool stuff like TLA plus, property testing is interesting. Static types are good. There are good tools to use. However, he's missing the part that the tool works bidirectionally between the people who want stuff and the actual machine language. Instead, it's looked as if we have a hammer, you know, sort of hammering on a roof, when in fact we're kind of building universes as we go along, really.
Oh, yeah, well, I would, yeah. Well, TLA plus, I thought he was just talking about we're going to have three-letter acronyms with this a long time.
Yeah, I think we should move to four-letter acronyms. I think the time of three-letter acronyms is over. That was Grandpa's time. Yeah, we started off, we had like C, right? And then and we had the two-letter acronyms.
Yeah.
So it was a good essay if you're interested in this topic. He admits he's new at it, which is, I think, fine. One of the reasons I included this is I love reading essays by people who are just figuring stuff out, and I kind of take a tour on, you know, here's what it's like when you get started. Do I remember being there? It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Next up is, I will never use a Microsoft account to log into my own PC.
Oh, no doubt.
This is Microsoft.
Every time that Microsoft virus gets on my computer.
So I have Microsoft Windows 10 here. I just reinstalled it about a month ago. And with Windows 10, it encourages you to sign in with a Hotmail account or Microsoft account, but you don't have to. Well, the rumor is with Windows 11, they're going to make it so you have to.
And I wonder how that's going to work for them.
I swear, James, it may very well be my last straw with this. I think I'm kind of, I've tried. They seem like they're trying to do the right thing. They've open sourced a bunch of code. They actually bought GitHub. They're doing cool stuff. but I don't want to associate identifying information even more so with my usage of technology. I've done too much of that already. I'm kind of done.
Yeah. You're one of those libertarian kind of people, though. You like your freedom.
Yeah. Friend of mine said, he was online on Twitter. He said, you know, I've got my concealed carry. I wonder what sort of weapon I should have. And I said, look, based on my extensive experience with video games, I would go with a rocket launcher, really, because you can take out a lot with a good rocket launcher.
Hard to carry that concealed, though.
Yeah, there were some problems.
One of the mini ones.
So this next one's really cool. It's called Feed Me Up, Scotty. And the idea is that you can take any web page and turn it into an RSS feed. And that's just freaking, it's like, this is so cool. It should have been here all along. It's just really, really cool.
All right. So tell me what I'm going to do with this.
Let's say you've got a Twitter or something, a news feed on LinkedIn or something like that. You can actually go in here, give it a title. Zoom a little bit here. It's got like
what problem is it solving, Daniel?
Well, it takes that web page that has recurring information, turns it into an RSS feed, which is an open spec. And so then you can consume it using an RSS reader without ads or anything else, instead of having to go to the site and see the dancing bears and all that other crap.
Okay, well, now you're talking. I can get rid of the ads? Okay.
Yes. It gets rid of the ads, and it takes whatever they're creating and turns it into just a list of stuff that you want to see that's updated as they update the material. The job boards, Facebook feeds, a friend's, a blog, whatever you want. If it's a repeating list of stuff, you just create one of these config files, and it goes through and makes an RSS feed for you.
Okay.
I love this. This is something I've actually coded up half-assed two or three times before, and I want to play around with this and get some time.
Let me know how it goes.
Yeah. It's fun stuff. You get into this... you can't use regex on HTML. It's all sorts of little fun paths to go down. Kepler telescope glimpses population of free-floating planets.
Yeah, that's cool. I've glanced through this article.
Yeah, it's making me very happy.
They didn't ever intend to do this with this telescope, they were saying.
Yes.
And
Well, now the scope broke, so they sent it into orbit or to study for planets around stars, and they lost what threw their gyro, so the scope ended up just being pointed at one spot all the time. And so even with a broken scope, even with a scope that wasn't meant to find these kinds of planets, they're still finding these planets, which is neat.
Yeah, and so they're like looking at the center of the galaxy, right? And they're looking for occlusion events where they think some body is bending, you know, a lensing effect where they think there's some body there. And now they're able to see these little... I don't know, I'm going to call them twinkles or whatever it is, but that shows that something moved in front of that light source and, bent the light out of the way, and so there's got to be something there, and they could make some guess about its mass and that sort of thing.
And this is a great example of taking data that was captured for one purpose and then running some machine learning on it to actually use it for some completely other purpose, which in this case is finding free-floating planets.
Oh, and so this is not new data being farmed?
No, matter of fact, they just went back and said, you know, we could probably, since we're looking at so many stars so clustered together, we could probably go back and look for a different kind of twinkle. And sure enough, they found signals. Yeah, cool stuff.
Us people doing research about.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to when they launch, well, James Webb is one, but I don't think Webb's going to be the scope people are making it out to be. I'm looking forward to some really cool stuff, maybe 20, 30 years out, if I live that long.
Yeah, I hope you make it.
Yeah, Elon's going to change a lot of stuff. If he can put 100 tons of cargo in low Earth orbit, we should be able to have all sorts of things we didn't have before. This is a sad story. Czechoslovakian drug addict fish.
That did catch my eye too. I feel really bad.
Yeah.
Why do these people keep dumping so much meth down their toilets? Why don't they just, you know, it's kind of expensive toilet cleaner, isn't it?
Well, yeah. It turns out this Czech researchers in Prague set out to investigate whether illicit drugs alter fish behavior. And so they got a big tank of water. They stuck 40 fish in there and I guess doped them up for a while. And it turns out that half of them ordered HBO Max, very unhappy with that result. And then there's a bunch of posting on Fish Facebook that they were upset about. No.
The fish are not sleeping anymore.
They never sleep. Yeah, geez. They moved all the rocks around from one spot to the other. They're trying to figure out at what level will this affect the fish. And this interests me in a couple ways. First of all, the stuff comes out of the toilets into the water. And then second of all, there's this question we've had for about 50 or 60 years now. It's like, at what level of environmental exposure, is something important?
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten, we can probably discover, environmental chemicals at 1,000 or maybe even 1,000,000 times more sensitivity than we could 50 years ago. But, atoms are really tiny little things. So if we just find a few atoms, does that really mean that's a problem?
Yeah, right. I think I was talking to Ron Jeffries once about homeopathic medicine, and he said, yeah, that's kind of a weird thing because they take this thing that's bad for you and they dilute it so much that there's none of it left in the solution, and then you take that and somehow it might have some benefit for you. It's like, that's... what did it do, leave a fingerprint behind on some other atom somewhere?
Yeah, it's I'm not a homeopathic guy, but you get things like cold fusion. It's like, well, it's like fusion happening, but it's not the temperature of the sun. It's still happening, though. It's like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening to that crustacean over my head there?
This is scientists find cocaine in UK shrimp.
Hmm.
Yeah, it turns out the shrimp disco is a big, big thing now. You get them down there dancing around. It's no good for the shrimp.
They don't have to crawl around in the carpet finding it anymore.
yeah.
With the Parmesan cheese, they can just go harvest some of these shrimp here and then boil them down and take the residue.
I think what we're really talking about here, James, let's just be honest. We're talking about a whole new kind of seafood restaurant, okay? Uh-huh. This could change seafood as we know it.
It could, yes, no doubt.
Mussels test positive for opioids.
I do like mussels, but I've never gotten a buzz from that I know of.
Well, that you just don't lay around in a shell all day unless there's something else going on, really.
They are like the little filters of the ocean.
They are. Mussels are really cool. If you've studied mussels, we've put some in our local river because they filter out everything.
Mm-hmm.
Cool little dudes.
Yeah, no unintended consequences for that?
I'm going to say jury's out, but I think the lesson the reader's supposed to take is that the world is ending and all the fish are doing drugs, and it's going to be a bad thing. If we legalize drugs for the fish, maybe it would be better for them.
So here's some research that's funded. I guess it's, interesting.
Yeah, I honestly don't know the answer. I mean, it would be easy just to poo-poo the whole thing. I know we're joking about it. We don't know at what level these chemicals can be cause a lot of harm or not. And to be honest, there could be a level that causes harm that only 1 in 1,000,000 people ever get the harm from. And so is that really harm? I mean, there's all the statistics come into play here. We can't have a risk. You cannot have a risk-free world.
Yeah, the whole world's history is based on risk reward, and so we've got to make choices.
Yes, and the population's always been notoriously bad at making risk reward choices.
Yeah, right. If one person dies, but hey, with your river, and you guys put mussels in there, is there any adverse effects to that? Like now, is it all just clogged with mussels, or
no? It's understandable. They actually they're putting the mussels in these big cages.
Yeah.
And so they'll put a big cage in the bottom of the river, would put a bunch of mussels in it, and then the mussels are just a big filter, and then they come by, I guess, a year or two later, pull the cages up, and they get, seafood or something. I don't know what they do with them.
No Jurassic Park approach where the mussels now escape the cage and now have taken over?
Nothing. I think they want that to happen because the mussels are a natural part of the ecosystem, but
not your river, though. You had to reintroduce. They're part of your river?
Well, they have. Well, yeah, all freshwater streams have some sort of mussel in them, right? I mean, it should have had.
I don't know.
I don't know either. Right? But I would
It's Great Lakes here by us, like the zebra mussels or something.
No, they're not indigenous, right? The zebra mussels.
A problem.
Yeah. Chinese or they're not U.S. mussels, are they?
Yeah, I don't know where they're from. Yeah, Africa, I guess.
Yeah, there's so many problems. There's the exposure level. There's the what actually belongs here versus what doesn't. What's the perfect state that we're shooting for? What's not? You know, it's a set of complex issues that are intertwined.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes
it... How could that be?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, what it means is we can infinitely argue about these things from here for the next million years, and that is really the important thing here, okay?
Yeah, humans like that, you know, so let's keep it up. Okay, good. All right.
Yeah, what about these good zebra muscles? Can you tame a zebra muscle? I mean, is it... We learned we cannot tame zebras a week or two ago.
Can you put a saddle on them or put a harness on them?
Yeah, I don't know why they call. I guess they're striped. I don't know why they call them zebra muscles. I don't think they're related to zebras.
The length of their tail, or probably not the stripes. That's too easy.
It would have to be striped. Okay, I don't. We will discover. We'll save that for homework. Next up is write code that is easy to delete, not easy to extend.
rm/
What?
rm-r/
Woohoo! It's like four characters all gone.
Easy to delete, not easy to extend. I didn't read this one. Tell me, what's the gist?
Well, this is a very long essay written by I would consider a senior programmer, and it is all about, I would say, how to slowly add complexity to your code base such that you can go and delete things at any time. So he talks about loose coupling, how people talk about that, but it's kind of difficult to actually implement. He talked about something I've ran into a few times, and I'm not ready to get the guns out on this yet, but, you know, dry is not always a good thing. At some point, you should probably repeat yourself two or three times just to be sure that you are repeating yourself, that you're not sort of repeating a spec. Instead, you're actually doing the same thing two or three times over again.
Yeah, it was. I ran into a YouTube video last night on that topic, which was, it's like, this is weird, getting a YouTube topic from a computer nerd from the UK that was talking about microservices and dry. It was pretty interesting talk, you know. So you create unnecessary coupling if you have a shared thing, you know. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I've completely changed the way I view programming because of microservices and functional code. I used to be that I would completely, as I coded, I would organize my stuff into classes, and I would use the list of substitution principle and dry and a bunch of single responsibility principle, all that stuff, keep things very clean and organized, and it was a thing of beauty. It was the right thing to do in an OO environment, but in a functional environment, I realized that was the wrong thing to do. It's better to write little short pieces of stuff that you can delete and plug in another piece. And that's a different skill set that requires a whole new way of thinking how to code. So I feel like it's one of those guys from Russia who defected to the United States. Like, I still know I have all my Russian friends, and I understand what you guys are talking about. It's just we don't do things that way over here anymore. But so this is good stuff. I see other coders and SAS sort of circle around the same topic about how to think differently about your code base, and I think it's healthy. I would be happier if they actually reached some useful conclusions, but, you know, who knows? Give them time.
So I think in the beginning it was an ANSI C expert of some sort, ANSI C in the very beginning of the article. I saw that caught my eye, ANSI C. So was that the author, or is he quoting somebody?
It said, "Oh yeah, every line of code is written without reason, maintained out of weakness, and deleted by chance." Programming in ANSI C.
Okay, that's a quote for the borrowed. Okay,
and so it goes over.
You know, next.
Go ahead.
So I think, you know, the couple of words you said earlier about extending or making it deletable. I don't know. I might be reading between the lines here, but extending, like subclassing behaviors, that's kind of generally a bad idea, unless, of course, the subclass needs everything that's in the base. But then deletable, replaceable, you know, you're talking about interfaces and that sort of thing. You know, and if you look at Bob's stuff on Solid, the O and the L in Solid are really about that attribute of code being able to substitute things. Right. Not so much using OO for extensions, but for substitutions.
Yeah, I know. I think Bob and I have covered this a couple times lightly, and he makes the point that, you know, OO is really to him about polymorphism more than anything else, because it allows you to do, you know, have a modular environment that you could do plug and play with.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I like I said, didn't want to get my guns out on this one. There's nothing wrong with it. I think the problem is that there are two ways of thinking of programming. Okay. Way number one is we have this open system called the computer that we fallible humans go to try to make do stuff, and we can never remember exactly what it does. So really the only way to have it do what we want it to, test first, you know, do regression testing, so we have a twin bookkeeping system. And once we start that, that implies how we organize the code after that. Everything kind of goes downstream from there. But the other way of looking at programming is that programming is just a set of mathematical transforms, and that if the transforms are correct, there's no way the code can be wrong. And that's a whole different thing.
Well, using Linux and the command line and the pipes and filters, you know, that's kind of part of the underlying idea there, is that you can take with the output of one thing and feed it to another thing. It doesn't mean you hook those pipes up properly.
Yeah. No. I think
you got them in the right order, right? You know.
No. I don't think
the tests pieces could be correct.
Yeah,
of the pieces wouldn't be correct.
Tests don't go away anywhere. I think what happens is you move tests up the OS level, and your tests are just checking to see if your microservices are communicating with one another properly, instead of what's going on inside of each microservice. So those microservices themselves should be, you rip one out, stick another in, the system keeps you running, everything is good, you know, Bob's your uncle, but the overall system is tested before it's deployed, and it's continually tested. So you don't get away from tests, but the way you test the overall system is a business user acceptance test. It's not a whether or not X equals 7 here or not.
Yeah, sure. But I was, even if the pieces are doing what you want them to do, it doesn't mean that you've combined them in a way to do what you need them to do.
Yes. Well, see, the thing, you're right. But the cool part about that is that modern languages allow us to pull the type system out of each microservice and then evaluate the whole overall system as if it were one huge program and the microservices are little functions in there. So you should always be able to know whether or not your functions are talking to one another correctly or not. It should never be a mystery.
Okay.
Supercompilers, my friend. It's going to all be supercompilers.
No, I don't know what those are yet.
I just told you. It's instead of functions in a C file, you got microservices on an OS, and instead of tests for each function where you write, you have acceptance tests at the OS level for each microservice for your deployed. It's just same thing, only bigger.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, I think that's about it. Let me see what we got here. I had some code, but we don't need to talk about that. So what have you been consuming this week, James? Have you been watching any movies, reading any books?
Let's see. I haven't had any time for any TV. I did have some grand boys come over, different than the ones that showed up last time.
Oh, that's a cute little kid.
Number 7 is brand new to the world. He's like a month old now, and he's moving to Colorado, so I'm not so happy about that, but maybe I'll be able to wear my hat when I go visit him.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, and so I've just been doing my thing, trying to get ahead of the game. I've got a training class coming up next week, which will be fun. I'm going to run it on GatherTown. It'll be my first full deployment on GatherTown with the Wingman Training Center, as I call it. So people will be able to get in, rooms together and pair program together. I'm hoping to encourage that. I won't mandate it, but I'm going to encourage it. And so that's going to be that'll be a fun thing. I maybe could report on that in a couple of weeks. I won't be here next week because I'm teaching that class.
I ended up buying 3 books, audiobooks this morning. One of which I was reading online. This person said, Aldous Huxley wrote a book called The Devils of Loudoun, 1965. He said, he really nailed what the modern culture is about. People fighting with one another. And I thought, well, that's an interesting comment. So I started researching it and couldn't find but maybe one or two reviews, but there was a movie. And, of course, Aldous Huxley wrote 1984, so he's a famous author.
But he wasn't 1980. That was Orwell.
I'm sorry, he wrote Brave New World. He wrote Brave New World.
Brave New World, yeah.
So there was a movie called The Devils, I think, in 1970. I looked that up, and that was like one of a few movies that Roger Ebert gave a zero to.
Huh.
It was despised by some, won several awards, including Best Director and all these other things. And I'm like, okay, so it's the worst movie ever, won all these awards, written by a famous author, can't... There was just too many contradictions. I got to get the book. I got to get the audiobook. So I downloaded that, looking forward to listening to it.
Have you listened to it yet?
No, sir. I just downloaded it this about an hour ago.
All right. Well, let me know what you think about it. How are you doing on your chemistry?
I stopped the chemistry for a while. I got into Lewis body diagrams, and I was just like, I couldn't do the picturing in my head. I needed to slow down. I was listening just sort of as I did other things. And take some more time with it. I may just bail out. I'm not sure. I'm not maybe 8 to 10 hours in. It's good stuff. I'm just not sure I'm going to need it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll continue with it. I had to put it down for a little while just because other stuff's in the way.
I really enjoyed life in ancient Mesopotamia, but I'm that kind of guy. I just finished that last week. Woohoo!
All right.
And you don't wait for the movie for that one. It's not going
Life in Ancient Mesopotamia. I'm sure it's good.
It's a great course of series, about 18 hours. It's a wonderful discussion of how life was 4,000 years ago. All right, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to bail out. What were you going to say?
There was this spoof a few years ago. I forget who was in it, but it was a spoof of Star Trek, and they would go, they had various episodes, and they ended up on this planet where social scoring was the big thing. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I want to say Black Mirror, but I'm not sure.
You know, it's kind of a comedy.
It was Orville. It was the Orville.
Yeah, the Orville, right. Yeah, it was a comedy spoof. And they end up on this planet where, you know, everybody's walking around with their phones upvoting people. And then, you know, you got shunned. And, you know, it's amazing how prescient that was. I mean, that's going on in...
I understand
China and to some extent here, right? You know, just
as I understand this book, and I haven't got into it yet, but it's basically, I guess, 1700s or 1800s in France. Everybody was congratulating themselves with the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, and how we're not burning witches like we used to, and we're such great people. And then they ended up with a witch scare, and they killed some people and tortured them to death, and just the whole society went down the tubes. Even though they all thought they were these wonderful, educated, you know, progressive type folks.
Yeah, they figured that out now. Hmm.
Yeah. Well, so it's not a happy story. I think one of the reasons the movie got panned was the director took it and just went as far as he could with the porn and the gore and everything he could do with devils and exorcism. He just turned up to 11.
Yeah, okay. When 10 would have been fine.
Probably 7 or 8 would have been good. That was just... So let me say goodbye here. So,
all right, Dan.
Hang on. And okay, there we go. You have wasted yet another hour. You could have been studying to be a doctor, a better programmer. You could have like taken a mail order course on various topics, but no, I had to stop by with us, and we're glad that you came by. I'm Daniel Martin with James Green this week. We'll see you on the internet.